From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is Away to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
It was for me a serendipity that an acquaintance recommended the book Braiding Sweetgrass by Robin Wall Kimmerer at this particular moment in time, as one year closes and another opens. The book's subtitle is Indigenous Wisdom, Scientific Knowledge, and the Teachings of Plants, and its author joins me today to share some of those. First, though, these messages.
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach, made possible from High Mowing Organic Seeds, the first independently owned farm-based seed company proudly serving organic gardeners and farmers with 100% organic and non-GMO vegetable, herb, and flower seeds. HighMowingSeeds.com/AwayToGarden. From Timber Press, the leader in fine garden books, The World of Laura Ingalls Wilder by best-selling author Marta McDowell. The revealing exploration of Wilder's connection to the landscapes of the American frontier is a must-read for Little House on the Prairie fans. From booksellers everywhere.
Today's guest, Robin Wall Kimmerer, describes herself as a mother, a scientist, a professor, and a member of the Citizen Potawatomi Nation. But I will let her tell you more about herself and about the plant called sweetgrass, from which we can all learn so much. Welcome to A Way to Garden, Robin. Thank you for joining me today.
I'm so glad to be here. Thanks.
Thanks. You write in Braiding Sweetgrass, "I'm a plant scientist, and I want to be clear, but I am also a poet, and the world speaks to me in metaphor." Can you tell me a little bit about your perspective in seeing the world?
Yes, I sometimes feel as if I really have feet in different places, you know, looking at the world through multiple lenses. And I am. I'm a botanist. I'm a trained plant biologist, plant ecologist. And those tools of science are so powerful for us, not only for interpreting the world, but for seeing the world clearly. But where sometimes in the scientific ways, we privilege the knowledge of the mind and the intellect and that which we can measure. But the voice of the poet and speaking in metaphors is how we feel. What are our relationships to that which we observe and those who we observe? So it's really important to me to have both of those lenses so that when we engage with the world, we do it with all of the gifts of the human, not just our intellect, but with mind, body, emotion, and spirit. And in indigenous ways of knowing, we are often reminded that we need to use all of those gifts in order to really understand our relationship to the world.
In the book, you tell, and I think I've also heard you lecture something that I watched online, I believe, a lecture you gave, and I forget where it was. It was earlier this year, I believe, at Yale. And you tell a story, as you write it in the book, about your first encounter at college and meeting who would be your advisor or something in a scientist, and a discussion you had in that first sort of interview moment about kind of what you were just talking about beauty. he asked you maybe what you wanted to learn. Is that what happened?
Yes, yeah. You know, I came from a childhood growing up out on the land where plants were my companions and my friends and my teachers. They really were my elders. And so then when I chose to study botany in college, I thought I was coming with an orientation to an appreciation and understanding of plants. But that first encounter with my freshman advisor let me know otherwise, because when I was asked, you know, so why do you want to study botany? And I answered, because goldenrod and asters are so beautiful together, and I want to know why. I want to know why they stand together. Why do they grow together and look so beautiful when they could grow apart? And, you know, I just think of the dismay with which my advisor looked at me, like, that's not science. And he said, you should go to art school if you want to study beauty. And you know, I was just a kid. I didn't have any resistance to that to that way of thinking. I didn't have the vocabulary to be able to say, well, actually, that's a really important question, which is not only aesthetic, but ecological as well, and perhaps physiological. But it was that was my first encounter into the scientific worldview and the quite large gulf between indigenous ways of thinking and scientific ways of thinking, where plants, my companions and teachers were suddenly in the scientific worldview. They were no longer subjects, but they became objects, kind of little green machines instead of my relatives.
Yes, and one of the plants that, of course, is the overarching subject metaphor of this book, and by the way, the book, Elizabeth Gilbert calls it a hymn of love to the world, which is just perfect. It's the plant called sweetgrass. So introduce sweetgrass to us a little bit.
Oh, it's such an amazing plant. Sweetgrass is a really good name for it, and in our language, her name is Wingushk. And in the Potawatomi language, Wingushk refers to that sweet fragrance, for sure, that wonderful vanilla-like fragrance, but it also refers to the fact that it is a ceremonial, sacred plant for us, and a teacher. It's also a healing plant, and the way that it heals is so interesting. Ecologically, it is a healer of broken open land. It's a pioneer species that comes and binds up the soil with its rhizomes. And but it's also a cultural healer, a spiritual healing plant as well. And when Linnaeus named that plant, he called it Hierochloe odorata, which means the sacred, fragrant, holy grass. So oftentimes our scientific names are kind of empty and mechanical, but he really got it right. And we revere that plant. We revere sweetgrass or Wingushk for a number of reasons, but one of which is in our oldest stories, sweetgrass is understood as the hair of Mother Earth, that sweet, shining, long hair. And just as we braid the hair of someone that we love to enhance their beauty, to care for them as a real tangible sign of our loving and caring relationship with one another, our people braid sweetgrass. And it is a metaphor and a pragmatic representation of our care for Mother Earth. And so I used that plant as the dominant metaphor for the book, which is a braid of stories, which are made up really of three strands, and two of which we've kind of talked about already. One of those strands is indigenous knowledge and traditional environmental thinking about plants from the native perspective. Another one of the strands of that braid of stories is scientific knowledge about plants. And then there's that third strand that makes up a beautiful braid. And the way that I think of that third strand is the knowledge that the plants themselves hold, that not what we can learn about plants, but what we can learn from plants. And so the book is this braid of stories that use those three different ways of knowing to reawaken our relationship with plants and to fully engage with all of our human ways of knowing how, the gifts that plants hold for us.
Well, the book is vast, and I keep doubling back again and again to certain places, but I want to try to home in on a few of the learnings that they're starting to come clear a little bit in my head as I read and reread. This is a time of year in our modern economy that's often about commercial gifting, you know. But you write of an entirely different kind of gift economy. And you say in the book, plants know how to make food from light and water, and then they give it away. So tell me about the gift economy.
You know, again, within my scientific community, what sometimes we call natural resources are what Native people call gifts.
Yes.
These are the creative products of other beings, just as we as individuals have our own particular gifts that we can give to the world. We view the plants and animals that way as well. And so plants, as these immensely creative beings, you know, certainly do make food and medicines and dyes and materials, and they hold knowledge for us in so many different ways that we think of those as gifts. And that language of thinking about them as gift rather than natural resources is really, I think, very important, because they, when we are given a gift, we know what to do about that, right? When we take natural resources, we take them without consequences. When we call them natural resources, well, they're ours, they're our property, we can do with them as we wish. But when we think about what the world gives us as gift, not as stuff that we're taking, but as gifts that are given, that engenders a whole different relationship to the living world, doesn't it? It suddenly invites gratitude, not expectation that I'll get more and more and more, but gratitude for what I have been given. It generates a kind of self-restraint in return for that gift. When you know it's a gift, it somehow makes you less greedy and more satisfied and appreciative of what you have. And the other way in which we know when we're given a gift, yes, we want to be thankful, we want to be respectful to that gift, but when we're given a gift, it also opens the door to reciprocity, to say, in return for this gift, I want to give something back. And that's the gift-giving economy. It's based not on an exchange of property, but an exchange based on reciprocity, so that in return for what's given, we want to give something back in return, which means we need to engage one another not anonymously, but as individual beings to consider what it is that we have to give to each other.
One of the other things that really appealed to me, and again, that I keep dipping back to certain parts of the book, is the importance of naming. And you sort of alluded to this a little bit earlier when you talked about, you know, things are relegated to being things. It's a thing. So naming being important, both about plants and other creatures, and also about a place. You say in the book, when we call a place by its name, it is transformed from wilderness to homeland. I thought that was a really powerful thought, and also about, also about the names, I guess the animacy, right, the grammar of animacy, you call it?
Oh, I'd love to, yes.
Yeah.
Naming is, it has so much deep meaning beyond just the words that we stick onto something, right? Because naming is a way, I think, that we form relationship. The very act of learning somebody's name, you know, if you have a neighbor whose name that you have not, you've chosen not to learn, right, that's a sign of disrespect, or I don't expect to be engaged with you. I don't need to know your name because we have no relationship. But when you learn someone's name, it's an invitation. It's an invitation to know one another and to help each other, to celebrate together, to have a real exchange, right? And so the very act of learning plant names is an invitation into relationship with them. And even though I'm a scientific botanist, I'm not talking about learning all the Latin names.
I know you're not.
The names even that we create are perfectly fine, because they're markers of respect and relationship with one another. And it's so important because, as you know, the conservation biology community has identified that in the United States we suffer from what they are calling plant blindness.
Mm-hmm.
that we don't really even see or consider the well-being of plants or the gifts that they share with us. And learning names is an antidote to plant blindness. So I really think that coming to know individual plants well enough to call them by name, either their official name or the name that works for you, is a marker of relationship.
Their personhood, yes, they have personhood.
Their personhood,
yeah.
Right, exactly. Mm-hmm. And you know, you asked about the grammar of animacy. Now, what do we do if we don't know a being's name? In English, we have the fallback of calling it,
yes,
right? And in fact, when we look at the English language, there's a peculiarity in the grammar. Grammar is a way we chart relationships, both in language and with nature. And in English, we have no way to refer to living beings except as it. You know, that sugar maple outside your window, we say it's growing there.
Yeah.
We would never say it about other human beings because it's disrespectful. It robs them of personhood. It's not dignity and agency. And yet the English language is constructed in such a way that that's the only way we have to speak about the living world. And I think the ramifications of that are profound, because the way we speak colors how we think. The way we think colors how we speak. And so it means that we're thinking about the rest of the living world, plants in particular, as objects. And once we think of it as an object, they're outside of our circle of ecological responsibility or ecological compassion, because they're its. But in the Potawatomi language, as well as many other indigenous languages, that's not how the grammar works. It would be impossible in Potawatomi language to refer to that same sugar maple or the squirrel sitting in its branches as it.
Yeah.
It's not possible. We refer to them with the same grammar that we do our family members, because they are regarded as our family.
It's funny with, I come at all this as a plant person for maybe 30 or 35 years, and I've only maybe in the process of gardening all these years in a rural place, I've met the other creatures, and more so as I've gotten older and more patient and able to sit still and watch and not be, you know, rushing off to the next chore. But even with that experience, I do use personal pronouns always for other living things, but with plants, I still think of it. And I was very struck by this, that how could I, even a person who plants have transformed, they're my constant companions of a lifetime, they've transformed everything I've ever done, and they mean so much to me and are my great delight, and yet I still say it. I think it. Whether I say it or not, but I'm thinking it.
Yeah. We've been conditioned to think that way. And Margaret, just as you said, well, you know, a lifetime with them, my gosh, you know, we shouldn't be speaking of them as it, right? Mm. And that was just my dilemma. And so I began thinking and talking to other language experts to think about, is there a way that, inspired by this grammar of animacy that we know of in indigenous languages, might we think of ways to animate English so that could we have a new pronoun that allows us to speak of the living world in a respectful way, not in as an object? And I've recently been writing and thinking about this, and the proposal for another pronoun is to use pronoun K-I, pronounced ki. It comes from a word that means an earth being in our language, Bamadzi Aki. Aki means the earth. And so might we use he, she, ki, and it. So we can save it for truly inanimate things, and use ki for both the squirrel and the sugar maple. And then when we have to speak of in plural, we already have a beautiful word in English that if we take that word key and just add an N to it, we have kin. And we can then speak of, you know, the geese flying overhead is, you know, kin are flying south for the winter.
Mm-hmm.
The kin are in our garden. So that rather than speaking of the natural world as object, we can speak of it as kinfolk. And that changes everything. When we start to think about the world as our relatives, as our providers, as our companions, as you know, it transforms how we are in the world.
I loved also the idea about the power of the collective. And in the last few minutes, just maybe we could take just 1 minute on this, and then I have one more question. You say the trees act not as individuals, but somehow as a collective. And we don't know how they do this, but they do. And that all flourishing is mutual, the idea of a community of trees. There's so much power in that. And we see it in nature, of course.
And I hope that we can be inspired by that as human individuals facing the uncertain future of climate change.
Yes.
That collective action taught to us by the trees can be a guide for us. You know, the plants know what to do about climate change. They are taking carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere and storing it. We as gardeners, as lovers of plants, as students of plants, could really follow that collective example and you know, set our intentions toward more and more carbon sequestration, right, of letting the plants do what they do best, plant more trees, plant more native species, restore, reclaim, you know, really work as gardeners are so gifted to be able to do to restore the green. You know, it is our collective responsibility. In return for everything that the plants have given us, we can do that.
You say it beautifully. Just then you said it beautifully, and you say it beautifully in the book. You say, from the very beginning of the world, the other species were a lifeboat for the people. Now we must be theirs. It's very, very well put. And I think a great way to think about winding down a year and starting a fresh year, again, with the intention of maybe being more tuned into that, yes?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Tuned into this and to, I like how you think of that as, you know, setting intention, that we as gardeners, as plant lovers, have this capacity that we really need to step up to the plate and use on behalf of all the living world.
Well, I've just been delighted to speak to you, Robin Wall Kimmerer, the author of Braiding Sweetgrass. I can't wait to get your book about moss that preceded it. That's next on my bedside table. and thank you for making the time.
I really appreciate it. Thanks.
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach made possible from Timber Press, the leader in fine garden books. The World of Laura Ingalls Wilder by bestselling author Marta McDowell. The revealing exploration of Wilder's connection to the landscapes of the American frontier is a must-read for Little House on the Prairie fans. From booksellers everywhere. From High Mowing Organic Seeds, the first independently owned farm-based seed company, broadly serving organic gardeners and farmers with 100% organic and non-GMO vegetable, herb, and flower seeds. HighMowingSeeds.com/awaytogarden.
Thanks to all of you for joining me, too. Now, don't miss an episode. You can subscribe free to the podcast version on Stitcher or iTunes. You can find me anytime at awaytogarden.com or facebook.com/awaytogarden. And happy gardening, meantime.
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of awaytogarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.